I'm Christopher Lydon, shaking this argument that Google is bad for your brain with the old-fashioned book enthusiast who made the line famous, Nicholas Carr. It's not just Google, he says, it's all that digital ocean of information and pictures and texts that people navigate now with their thumbs at real cost to their brains, Nick Carr says. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one goes a little beyond all those laments for deep reading and slow culture. Nick Carr says the brain science shows that life on the web at the speed of light is actually tearing up the neural networks of the mind that makes us human. Almost like bad drugs, you'd say, Nick Carr.
I'm a little wary of using the addiction metaphor because I think it is used a bit much, but I do think that the tools we use to think with, and the internet is certainly one that we're using more and more to gather information, to exchange information, have not only an effect on our habits, in the habits of the way we think, but have a deep neurological effect as well.
We're used to this notion of a plastic brain, that a baby's brain is formed by mom looking it deep in the eye and this sort of thing. What do you suppose digital technology does to the brain?
I think it shifts the emphasis of our thought. I think that everything we find about the online world emphasizes skimming and scanning and browsing and taking in a whole lot of information very quickly, jumping from link to link, all of which is good in and of itself, but it provides no impetus, no opportunity, no place for quieter, more solitary, more attentive ways of thinking.
But I'm talking about the neural networks themselves. What does it do?
What we know is that even when we're adults, so this doesn't just apply to children, although their brains are the most malleable, when we do anything, particularly when we do it repeatedly, we change the strength of the connections between our neurons, the synaptical connections, and we also change the cellular structure of those connections themselves. So if you repeatedly multitasking online, you know, looking at many different things all at once, you'll strengthen at a biological level the cellular connections that support that way of thinking. On the other hand, if you neglect certain cellular connections, certain neural pathways, for instance, those that support a high degree of attentive thought, sustained attention to one thing, which is difficult anyway, those connections will weaken, and ultimately the brain's very good at repurposing cells to, you know, taking them from away from what you're not using and applying them to what you are using.
Yeah, but the question is how bad and compared to what? I mean, a martini kills any number of hundreds of thousands of brain cells. Smoking's got to be bad. Sleeplessness, who knows whether running is good for your brain. How bad is the web?
Despite, you know, some of the rhetoric that surrounds my work, it's not about killing off brain cells the way alcohol will, for instance. It's not about rotting your brain. It's about exercising certain modes of thought, the skimming and scanning modes, and strengthening those and weakening the very different modes of thought that go into contemplative thinking, introspective thinking, reflective thinking. And these kind of shifts, which can actually happen quite quickly, they don't go away when you turn off your computer or turn off your cell phone. They persist and they continue to influence the way you think even when you're not online.
You talk about skimming, bad word. What about searching, another great function on the web? What about connecting? What about being expressive?
I certainly have gained great benefits from the web, being able to search and filter information very quickly, finding lots of information that used to be difficult to come by. I'm not suggesting that the net is bad. There are many good qualities about it. What I am suggesting is that there's a whole realm of thought that I think is very important to the richness of our personal intellectual lives, but also very important to the building of culture that requires an attentive mind. We don't want to sit alone in a dark room thinking about one thing all day long. But neither do we want to be processing a constant influx of texts and messages and doing Google searches and clicking on links all day long. And yet that is where I think as a society we're headed.
Look around the day-to-day effects, which we all notice now. I notice it at the university where every kid is always got the computer open Googling every reference in a class or even in a conversation. I noticed that my grandchild, who's brilliant with her thumb, she can write a long letter with her iPhone in her pocket, draw up a kind of balance sheet of what's good and bad in this transformed world. And it is transformed.
Well, let's look at the negative side of the ledger first. There have been plenty of studies by now on how the characteristics of the internet as a medium, things like hyperlinking, things like interruptions, which it's a very good system for and which are valuable in many cases, distractions, media multitasking, where we're juggling lots of things on screen, all of these things divide our attention. And what we know about the brain is that there's a whole lot of deep processes that begin with the act of paying attention. That's how we get information from our short-term working memory into our long-term memory. That's how we build deep conceptual knowledge. That's how we create links inside of our own mind rather than out in a database that gives richness to our thought, I think. And so all of the characteristics of the web, even though we benefit from them, and that's why we use it so much, divide our thought, divide our attention, and we never activate some of the deeper mental functions that are available to us. On the other hand, all those characteristics that might have a negative consequence in that way are also ones that benefit us. So we love to be connected. We love to get new information. We love to be able to express ourselves in certain ways that the web allows. We love to be making connections with lots of people. So you can't, I don't think you can disentangle the bad aspects from the good aspects. I think everything that makes the web so compelling and the reason we use it so much is also leading us away from calmer, more contemplative modes of thinking that are also essential to the well-rounded mind.
Yeah, but don't be shy about the negative tilt of your book. It's called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. It's not good news as you see it, and I think I may fundamentally disagree. But take the college student with the computer who's basically outsourced her brain or outboarded it as you would a boat engine. I look at these kids and I wonder, isn't that wonderful? If the Library of Congress, as a collection of information, or the British Museum, an infinite collection of books, is a good thing for people, why isn't it good to have instant access to it? You know, we don't put down the Library of Congress as an outsourced history or an outsourced literature. We say, praise God, it's there, and now we can get in.
I think one of the key aspects of all intellectual technologies, all information technologies, back to, you know, the scroll and the tablet, is that it provided a way to store information that used to be stored inside our own head. And when we have that as a supplement to our own biological memory, it's obviously very, very valuable. It lets you overcome time and space in collecting information, having access to what other people are thinking. The difference here, I think, and we see it in the rhetoric about outsourcing memory, the outboard memory, is that we're beginning to believe that with access to these incredibly rich databases all the time, that we don't have to commit information to our memory, that this is not just a supplement to memory, it's a replacement. And what happens then, and in fact, you see it in the metaphors we use about our brains, we're increasingly thinking about our own memory as kind of a hard drive. But the research shows us that our own memory is nothing like a hard drive. It's a very organic, and flawed, and that's part of it, but a very organic way of organizing our experiences, the information we have, on a very personal level. By making internal connections, that's how we get a distinctive intellect, and that's how the information becomes more than just a utilitarian resource that you tap into to find a fact or to answer a question. And when we bypass the consolidation, as neuroscientists say, of memory, of long-term memory, I think we end up with much less interesting minds and even personalities and even selves, even though we have access to many more facts and much more information than we ever had before.
I owe it to your book, Nick Carr, the Socrates view that we shouldn't write anything down because any text outsources memory, and memory is where we live. But in today's context, that's an unimaginable view.
It seems ridiculous when we hear Socrates saying, you know, the alphabet was a bad thing and we shouldn't be writing things down. On the other hand, you know, if He was almost certainly right that as we move from an oral culture to a written culture, we probably did lose something. We don't value it anymore because we don't have it. That's one of the things technology does, is it devalues what it replaces over time. But nevertheless, it was clearly what we gained from the alphabet in writing and reading, it seems to me, and to many other people, and to most other people, outweighed what Socrates was fearing we were losing.
Take a completely different instance of the way the internet affects everyday life. And that is simply that my grandchild knows intuitively, and in fact, that geography is different from it was when you and I were kids, that the whole world is equally in reach. It's equally relevant. It may be equally smart. It may be equally interesting. There's no pride of a particular place. And it seems to me, in many ways, that's a big gain, particularly given that other factors, global warming, war, hunger, are global crises that can only be tackled by people with the imagination or with the evidence that they can believe.
I wouldn't disagree with that. On the other hand, there's also aspects of the net that push us toward more extremism and more parochialism and more nationalism. One thing we know about ourselves is that if you start gathering information with a coming at it from any kind of with any kind of bias, you'll tend to give greater weight to the information that supports that existing bias. And the more information you gather, the more extreme your view becomes. And I think we see people able to gather many viewpoints and to broaden their understanding of the world. We also see many people becoming narrower and narrower and more extremist and beginning to only listen to those that support their view. And I mean, that's been going on in media for a long time, so I don't think it's anything new. And I don't think it negates what you said about the fact that we can gain a much broader perspective. On the other hand, I'll come back to the point that it's one thing to have access to that information, to gather it, to be exposed to it, but the other half of our intellectual lives is about going deep into that information, not just having access, not just finding it, searching for it. And I worry that the web is putting all the emphasis on that first aspect of intelligence, the information gathering, the access to it, and is not putting any emphasis on, okay, you found some information, relevant information, now stop and think deeply and think for yourself about this information. So I don't think more is always necessarily better.
Nicholas Carr, maybe we should have met out in Sleepy Hollow in Concord, Massachusetts, where, as you write, Nathaniel Hawthorne in 1844 wrote a kind of reflection on the stillness, the beauty of the breeze, the gentlest sigh imaginable, and the coolness of the day that breathed upon the spirit itself, which shivers with gentle delight, he wrote, and then the shriek, the whistle, the intrusion, the ugliness of a locomotive passing by. This is an old problem of technology breaking what seemed to be a moment of calm. I love the scale of the change that you make clear in the book. Digital technology is bigger than the train, bigger, I think, than the printed word. I mean, it's an epical change, like the first lizard that made it onto dry land. But then what? How do we put it in the context of this endless fear of change in technology?
Well, I think the passage you're referring to from Hawthorne's notebooks is a beautiful expression of what is available to us through solitary, very attentive, very quiet thinking. And Leo Marx, in his great 1960s book, The Machine in the Garden, draws a contrast between what he calls the pastoral form of mind, which is what Hawthorne's expressing there, in the more industrial form of mind, which is also important. It's, the way we solve problems, the way we move progress forward in some way, the utilitarian mode of gathering information and making decisions. And so this is a long-term shift that dates back at least to industrialization, where we see this constant pressure to be more utilitarian in our mental lives and more problem solvers. And what we lose is that pastoral sense. And Hawthorne, definitely saw this when he heard the train disrupt his deep thought. And so I think the best way to look at the internet is in that long progression, that long shift in emphasis of our thought, in the constant, I think, devaluation of the more pastoral, more contemplative mode of thought, which some people, I think, you know, almost make fun of today as being weird. Oh, you know, what a bookworm, or, you know, we're even getting a language that seems to suggest that there's no value in solitary thinking. You know, if you can be sending text messages or you know, checking your email every 3 seconds and being connected, which is a very powerful feeling, why back away from this? And so I think we're at risk of at losing this deeper personal solitary mode of thought without really even paying much attention to what we're losing.
Stick with those transcendentalists out in Concord for a moment. Thoreau didn't like the train either. But just down the road, Emerson was writing in the 1830s and 40s about the universal mind in a way that I find absolutely prophetic of the internet and the world we've entered finally. I think Emerson would be overjoyed for so many reasons. First of all, it's an expressive device for everybody. And he's the man who says, you know, you must be a nonconformist. You must speak for yourself in this moment. Trust thyself. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. All that kind of individualism is fulfilled on the web as never before. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be connected. You don't have to be a publisher to publish, etc. But at the grandest scale, too, Emerson was always advocating the universal mind, to which we are all, as rational people, admitted. He read Indian poetry and Persian literature, and he rejoiced in the singular species. And finally, we have in the internet not just a metaphor, but a machine to fulfill it. That seems to me to be the answer that Emerson would have offered, you know, over a walk through Concord to your friend Hawthorne.
That may well be true. On the other hand, I think he would have also been at least a little bit nervous about the erosion of his concept, I think, of self-reliance and of being able to see things on your own terms, which requires a backing away as well as a connecting. And I think if he saw how people are actually using the web, and certainly there are some who are using it to express themselves in a way that was never possible for them before, and to find access to, you know, important works of literature or other writings that they couldn't find. But, you know, most people are using it to go to Facebook, to do social networking, to kind of be in a stream of fairly trivial and in some ways reductive kind of ways of thinking about themselves, and are giving up the kind of distance from constant social activity that can actually flatten our minds. So on the one hand, I agree with you that he would have been there's much here he would probably would have been excited about, but I'm not sure his enthusiasm would have been unbridled.
Well, no, and you got to be nervous about everything. On the other hand, individualism, self-reliance, speaking in one's own name, being free, as you said, you must, to change your opinion tomorrow. Don't worry about consistency, the hobgoblin of little minds and all that good stuff. It seems to me we've never had the device that the internet gives us to be Emerson's ideal.
Well, we've always had pens. I mean, we've always had...
Not everybody. I doubt more people had access to pens and writing in Emerson's time than have access to computers and expression today.
I'm sure if you went with raw numbers, you'd be right, because there's a heck of a lot more human beings around today. I'm not sure about percentages.
A lot of illiterate farmers out in that part of the world.
Oh, sure. On the other hand, you had a tradition, and maybe it was a minority tradition, as these things tend to be, of deep kind of literary thinking, of a realization, and I think Emerson, when he talks about books, is extremely eloquent about this, of the ability to, through books and through other long-form written words from great minds, to really immerse yourself in another person, another very thoughtful person's world and worldview, and then make it your own. And that moment of transformation, I think, of other people's thoughts into your own thoughts was very important to him. But I think that process is the kind that needs quiet, that needs some time to immerse oneself in a book, to become a transparent eyeball out in Sleepy Hollow or whatever. And it's that's being shut off from us by the web, by that constant impinging on our consciousness all sorts of messages, all sorts of tweets and text messages and instant messages and everything else?
The answer, as a writer on our site said, is, Chris, only disconnect. You don't have to be there all day, and I'm not. My own Facebook experience is different from what you describe. What's yours? I mean, I get a lot of good news, a lot of good tips, a lot of thoughtful folk and even suggestions about books on Facebook. For you, Nick Carr, what's the warning experience on Facebook?
I dropped my account a while ago, so I'm not on it anymore. But if you look at, you know, Facebook now is by far the most popular website out there. People spend enormous amounts of time on Facebook. And it's great. I mean, I have no problem with staying in connection with your kindergarten friends and everybody since then. I don't see that kind of experience promoting kind of Emersonian thought. And if you look at how people's habits are evolving, they're not online. They're not going toward deep thinking or even deep expressiveness. The trend is always toward more and more streams of information. We're even moving from the page as the formative metaphor for information online to the stream, where you constantly are being bombarded awash in little bits of information. And those are very compelling to us naturally, I think, because if you're not in the stream, you feel socially isolated. But I don't think they're promoting deep creative thinking.
For me, the alternative is television. The web, even Facebook, talking about what you had for breakfast is so much more expressive and energetic and forward than sitting there and being bombarded by a cathode ray tube.
It's a nice thought that we're trading off time we'd spend looking at television for time we'd spend communicating through our computer or through our cell phone. But in fact, TV viewing throughout the web era has been growing. Nielsen goes out and measures our media use. And last year, TV viewing hours for the average American hit their peak since it started looking at this, you know, in the 50s. And the people who are online most tend to also be watching the most TV. So I think if you look at our media practices, you see that TV continues to grow. And you look at our online practices, you have to, even granting that you can spend hugely valuable time online, there's a heck of a lot of time that is just wasted, that people just waste online. So you add that to our pre-existing time we spend watching TV, and suddenly you see that a whole lot more time is being wasted staring into screens than before the internet came along. So I'm wary of saying, oh, we're being freed from TV, if the statistics show us still watching as much, if not more, TV than ever before.
Nicholas Carr, I'm worried about everything, even my enthusiasm for the web. I keep thinking of Robert Putnam's observation that the history of the 20th century was the history of the intrusion of technology into personal space. I mean, no more piano in the parlor as soon as the radio and television and phonographs came in. That progress of technology into our private spaces, into our brains, is an onward, scary march. I'll grant you that. I also wonder, though, if we don't exaggerate the dangers. You quote T.S. Eliot in 1916, writing to Conrad Aiken, that the typewriter makes for lucidity. He granted that, but I'm not sure that it encourages subtlety. In the long perspective, that seems a ridiculous worry.
It's true that he then went on to write The Wasteland, which is, some people think, quite subtle. I think there's always a worry, and I spend a lot of time in the book going through all these worries that have come along, because I find even when they're wrong, they tell us something about the course of technology and what the trade-offs are. And I'm sure there was a trade-off in going from writing by hand, writing in cursive, to typewriting. I don't know if it was good or bad or indifferent or little of both. What I see with the net, though, is a technology unlike the typewriter or the calculator or other things that people have worried a lot about. Telephone is something increasingly that is always with us. I mean, there are people today who wake up in the morning, the first thing they do is check their BlackBerry or their iPhone, and it goes constantly until they go to bed, when the last thing they do is check their iPhone or their BlackBerry. And so, your point about the intrusion of technology into the most personal, most intimate aspects of ourself, it seems that what we're seeing now with the net is kind of the culmination of that trend.
This will sound grandiose, but what do we want from our media in the long run? It seems to me we want media that encourage that Emersonian sense of the grandeur of our possibilities, the infinitude of the private man, as Emerson said. We also need devices that connect the world in a constructive way in a time of absolute emergency for the species. I can't imagine a better device, Nick Carr, than what comes along at this moment than the internet. And I say that with all sorts of reservations and respect for your worries about it. Give us the last warning.
Well, I think Marshall McLuhan's warning that we're always bedazzled by the content coming through media. The content, and certainly there's all sorts of riches coming through the web, is the piece of juicy meat that the media throws to what McLuhan called the watchdog of the mind to keep it distracted from the deeper cognitive effects the medium is having. So I think even as we celebrate all of the richness of content that maybe we're creating, maybe we're looking at online, we have to pay attention to the habits of mind that it is enforcing on us and look at whether it's giving privilege to a certain set of habits and devaluing others that may be at least as, if not more important than the ones it's promoting.
Nicholas Carr, it's a great pleasure. I enjoyed your book enormously. What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, The Shallows. And we think about these issues all the time. We will keep thinking about them with gratitude to you. And thank you, too, for this conversation.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Paul McCarthy, Ben Mandelkern, and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.